Welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Novels, movies, music, comic books, video games, comic cons, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. This is episode 18, and you can find the show notes at ump.fm. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is... Wait, who the hell is Casey?
Now, I would love to know myself, because everyone keeps asking me, and I don't know the answer, apparently.
I'm sorry. I could not resist. He's a software and iOS developer by day, but he's best known for his podcasting on shows like Analog and the Accidental Tech Podcast, one of the essential weekly tech programs. He is, of course, Mr. Casey Liss. Casey, welcome to the show.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. I couldn't resist. It's the joke that keeps on giving.
It really is. And the funny thing is, it was a dear friend of mine who wrote this song. And
Was that a friend of yours?
Yeah. So to fill in the listeners, in case you really genuinely don't know who I am on this show, the Accidental Tech Podcast, with John Siracusa, who is a fairly famous podcaster and writer within the Apple sphere, and Marco Arment, who you might know, among many other things, as the co-founder of Tumblr. And I'm kind of this other guy that just kind of appeared out of nowhere. And as it turns out, it's because I'm good friends with both Marco and John. But a good friend of mine, shortly after ATP started, wrote this song. And the gist of the song is, John Siracusa has written all these great OS X reviews. And Marco Arment co-founded Tumblr. And Casey.
Who the hell is Casey?
So it was really, like, I probably would have found it funny regardless of who had written it, but since it was a dear friend of mine, I still giggle about it every time.
And even better, yeah. So let's get on with the show, and why don't you tell us what you've chosen, and then give us some context around, this isn't a work as a sort of body of work, so give us some context around what it is, why, you know, people react to it the way they do, why it's maligned, and why you think that that is incorrect.
So, Anthony, I went back and forth about what I could talk about tonight, and I think the most obvious answer for both of us was to talk about Nickelback. No, I'm just kidding. To talk about the Dave Matthews Band, which for a long time was bar none my favorite band in the entire world. Now I'm not so sure I would say that anymore, but certainly one of my favorites to this day. I think we're probably going to use the album Before These Crowded Streets as kind of an exemplar of their work. But like Anthony said, we're going to be talking about the Dave Matthews Band in general, kind of what they are, who they are, how they do their thing, how they make music. And we're going to focus in large part on Before These Crowded Streets, which is an album of theirs that they came out with in 1998, as kind of the example, because to me, Before These Crowded Streets specifically was kind of the pinnacle of Dave Matthews Band's studio recordings. And in a lot of ways, it was the pinnacle of my love of Dave Matthews Band. So why are they hated? Honestly, I'm not entirely sure. So I'm going to turn to you, Anthony, in a second to answer this question. But my understanding is that because they were very popular in the late 90s and early 2000s, and because they were like a college band, they were associated with like the well-to-do preppy kids that all went to like fancy colleges and had like Dave Matthews playing in their sorority and frat houses. And they were all, I'm trying to think of a kind word that doesn't begin with D, but they were all kind of, they're all kind of self-involved. Let's go with that. And Dave Matthews Band, a lot of people seem to think that their music is not very good or not very interesting. Obviously, it's a very subjective thing, but hopefully I'll turn the corner on that a little bit by the end of this episode. But they reached their pinnacle in the late 90s and early 2000s, and yet still seem to have survived some way, somehow. And still, as of just a few years ago, and I don't have any facts in front of me to corroborate this, but as of a few years ago, they were still one of the highest paid touring acts in the United States. And so clearly someone is still listening to them, probably not unlike Nickelback, all kidding aside, but for whatever reason, they seem to be very maligned. And on ATP, Marco Arment loves to kind of push my buttons and say that Dave Matthews Band isn't a jam band. And his beloved Phish, the band Phish, P-H-I-S-H, is apparently not the only jam band, but is apparently the epitome of jam bands. And Dave Matthews Band is just a poser. And among the homework that I'd asked Anthony to do, of which there was a long list that no sane human would have completed all of, and I think, Anthony, you had said you had done most of it, which is extremely kind of you, on the list of songs for him to listen to were three different versions of the same song entitled Seek Up, which actually coincidentally is not from Before These Crowded Streets. But it was a really good exemplar of the different styles of the Dave Matthews Band and how they've kind of evolved over the years. Why do I like Dave Matthews? I think mostly because, I don't know if I should say mostly because of nostalgia, but largely because of nostalgia. When this particular album that we're talking about, Before These Crowded Streets, came out in 98, I was a sophomore in high school. I was just kind of establishing who I was. I was barely a human, let alone an adult at that point. And so this was a very, these are your formative years in many ways. And I had just seen the Dave Matthews Band live for, I think it was the first time. That's right. I'd only seen them live once and actually did not particularly care for it. But then I'd heard an album of theirs, which was a live album, and realized, wait, actually, they were really good live. And then this album came out, and it was like that perfect storm of all the right things at all the right time that just made me love it. And this is very similar to what you and Will Wheaton were talking about in your episode about Tron, in that for Will, it was just all of these things just came together at the exact right moment, and it just clicked. And I think that Before These Crowded Streets specifically, and the Dave Matthews Band in general, is very much that for me.
Okay, so... Right, the elephant in the room for me here is REM.
Interesting, okay.
Well, partly because of what you've just said. I was in high school when I discovered REM. They just released Document, I think, when I was entering high school. And that was my entry into REM. And it was much the same thing. It was a combination of, you know, everything just kind of coming together at the right time,
sure,
for me to get into them. And they became, again, another parallel, they became my absolute number one favorite band for several years. Like, you know, blowing all others, even bands like Motorhead or the Sisters of Mercy, which were, you know, sort of perennials for me. But REM just came along and they were so different at the time. So unusual, so authentic, which to a high schooler is obviously really important, that they just became a number one band. And since then, I still like them. I still listen to them a lot,
yep,
but no longer my number one band. So there is, we've got quite a bit of parallel there, just separated by 10 years.
No, but you're very right. And I still listen to Dave Matthews periodically, probably more often than I admit to myself. But it's funny because music, you could say this about pretty much any form of art, but for me, anyway, music particularly, if I put on the right album, like Before These Crowded Streets, can just take me to that time in my life. And in many ways can put me in that state of mind, a state of mind that I don't really remember all in all. Like, I remember being in high school, but I don't really remember what it's like to be a, 15, 16 year old. I don't really remember what that felt like. And yet I'll put on this album and it's so eerie because all of 16 year old Casey comes out and kind of gets ensnared with, how old am I? 33-year-old Casey.
Well done.
And it's the weirdest thing because it's almost as if there's two me's kind of enjoying the music at the same time. And now I sound psychotic, but I don't know. Hopefully that makes a little bit of sense.
No, I do know what you mean. You can appreciate it now, but you can also remember how you appreciated it at the time.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's funny you should say about memories. Something that always comes up for me, nothing at all to do with this kind of music, there is a particular Jean-Michel Jarre album, Zuluk, which whenever I hear it, and I love it, it's my favorite album of Jarre's because it's really experimental and strange. But whenever I hear it, it transports me back to being again in high school and playing Jet Set Willy, an old computer game on my computer in my bedroom, because I just used to, I don't know, I used to listen to Jarre and I was listening to that particular album when I was playing that particular game. And it just has this really strong sense memory. I hear it and instantly I'm 14, 15 years old again, playing Jet Set Willy on my computer in my bedroom.
Yeah, it's so weird how it sounds like you and I are cut from the same mold, and that music is a very good way to do that. But it's so weird how music can, for a lot of people, for me and you, it seems, can put you in that frame of mind that you, in many ways, have lost connection with. Like, you know, my wife and I have just had our first baby. I can barely remember what it's like to be much less than, you know, or I can barely remember what it was like more than a year ago, let alone all that time ago in high school. And yet I'll put on an album like this and it's, and suddenly I'm there again.
Okay. So let's talk about the band themselves. And it's the way that Marco on your podcast has a go at you for Dave Matthews. Now that I have heard some Dave Matthews, because this is the other elephant in the room, I had never knowingly heard a Dave Matthews Band song before I listened to the stuff that you sent me.
Interesting. And that's both surprising and not. Dave Matthews Band was hugely popular, obviously among the college crowd and into high school to a lesser degree. But they were also, a few of their songs crossed over into just general pop stations. Songs like Satellite, What Would You Say is another great example, that more, I would say more than half of America has heard these songs and would at least recognize them. But my understanding of the Dave Matthews Band is that they never got that terribly popular in most of Europe. I couldn't tell you one way or another about the UK, but it seemed like a lot of mainland Europe didn't really ever get it. And so it's both surprising to me as an American that you never really heard them, but unsurprising to me in that you are not an American, that you hadn't heard much of it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know exactly what you're saying. And I think that is part of it. Yeah. I genuinely don't know if they are popular over here or not, but certainly, as I say, I'd never knowingly heard a song by them anyway. But now that I have, it's even more hilarious to me that Marco has a go at you about liking this band, because I'm just like, okay, I come from the comic book world, and this Fish versus Dave Matthews Band argument to me seems like what it must be like for people like you when my crowd argue about who's stronger, Hulk or Thor.
right. Because it's the same thing.
It's like they're the same band.
Yep. I totally understand that. I should be deeply offended, but I totally understand that.
Well, I mean, obviously they're not. I'm being hyperbolic.
Sure.
It's like from an outsider's point of view, it's like, how can you possibly be tribalistic about these two bands when they're so similar?
Yep. And it's actually, if you'll permit me a segue, that's a very interesting point, because part of the reason I think I like the Dave Matthews Band so darn much, and I actually was listening to Before These Crowded Streets a couple of hours ago, just reminding myself, just to be sure I'd caught all the nuance of it. And I think, to me, the difference between Fish, which I've heard a decent amount of, and the Dave Matthews Band, is that Fish's emphasis seems to be lead guitars. But, you know, Trey Anastasio's lead guitar work, it seems to be the emphasis of Fish's sound.
Right.
Whereas Dave Matthews Band, to me, emphasizes more of the rhythm section. I think the strongest members of the Dave Matthews Band, unequivocally the strongest, is Carter Beauford, their drummer, but followed actually reasonably closely behind by Stefan Lessard, their bassist. And the reason I bring up having re-listened to Before These Crowded Streets just a little while ago is because I hadn't ever really paid that close attention to Stefan Lessard's bass work on this album. And God, is it good. Like, I really didn't realize how good it was until literally today. And I think the difference between Marco and I is that he just tends to enjoy that really solid lead guitar work in a way that I like it, but it doesn't really, you know, rev my engine like it does his. Similarly, I tend to, in all forms of music, like really solid rhythm sections, just really good rhythm sections. And the lead guitar and singing and whatnot don't really matter to me. And God knows, if you're going to be a Dave Matthews Band fan, you cannot be that interested in lyrics, because, oh, are they bad.
Well, and there's not a lot of lead guitar either. I mean, Dave Matthews himself plays acoustic guitar like 90% of the time, from what I can see.
That's absolutely right. Now, they do have another guy who's kind of an honorary member of the band, Tim Reynolds, who is, to my ear, a phenomenal lead guitarist. But to your point, that's not really the emphasis of the music. The emphasis of the music, if anything, is either just the eclectic lineup they have in terms of instrumentation or the rhythm section.
Okay, so let's go back to this REM thing, because that is, I mean, there's the parallel with my own sort of love of REM, but also when I started listening to these albums, I did think they do kind of sound a bit like REM.
Oh, yeah?
But without good songs. which I know is a horrible thing to say, but I'm just, The one of the reasons that I got into REM so much was because their songwriting, especially in the early albums, was so good, so dynamic, so simple but powerful. Just really, really, you know, great songwriting ideas. I didn't get much of a sense of it's, which is ironic given what you just said about the rhythm section, but I didn't get much of a sense of dynamics in this music. It just kind of, it sounded very American college radio.
And that's kind of what it is. So that's not an unreasonable determination to come to.
Yeah, there's a certain approach to modern rock music that seems to separate US and UK bands, and it's really hard to put my finger on. It's one of those terrible things that I know it when I hear it, but this is definitely it. And now I know, having researched, that Dave Matthews was actually born in South Africa, mm-hmm. but he moved to America when he was like 2 years old. So basically he's American. And I don't think that I would have had any trouble guessing that this was an American band if I didn't already know. Do you understand what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's, I don't know. It's, I think part of the reason I love the Dave Matthews Band, I mean, I've already talked to you about the rhythm section. When I listen to music, I don't really care about the lyrics. And I know for a lot of people, that's just mind-blowing. But it's very rare that I listen to a piece of music and think to myself, geez, those lyrics are awesome. It's always, oh, I really like that thing that Boyd did on the violin. Or, oh, that bass riff that Stefan did was awesome. Or, especially with the Dave Matthews Band, how is Carter Beauford playing 18 drums at the same time? How is that possible? And so for me, I think because the sorts of things I enjoy are maybe different than a lot of people, it makes it a lot easier for me to enjoy the Dave Matthews Band. Dave Matthews is not a particularly great singer. I think he's actually a better guitar player than people give him credit for, but I still would not say he's a remarkably great guitar player. And he's not a great singer. And God, like I said, his songwriting is, or the lyrics are just insane. I am not a man who has ever really done any sort of drug. I like myself a glass of alcohol more often than I probably should, but I'm not a drug user. And I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying it's never really been my thing. And so I feel like if I was someone who had experimented with like LSD in the past, then maybe these lyrics would make more sense or something, but they are almost unintelligible.
Speaking of somebody who has dropped a few in his time, no, not really.
Well, I was holding out hope, but now that question has been answered.
But talking about lyrics, I mean, I do understand where you're coming from. I mean, it depends what kind of mood I'm in. I'm also a huge fan of like prog rock and bands like Genesis.
Oh, okay.
Where the lyrics are really important. But I also equally, I'm an enormous Motorhead fan. And early REM, you couldn't even make out the lyrics, let alone understand them, you know. So it's, when I say songwriting, I'm not just talking about the lyric writing. I do mean, you know, sort of musical songwriting as well.
Sure.
I mean, another more modern, showing my age here when I say more modern, a more modern example would be White Zombie. Mm-hmm. Who were like around when you were in high school. Sure. But you know, again, the lyrics pretty awful and very repetitive, you know, not particularly interesting, but the dynamics in the songwriting, the musical dynamics, lift those lyrics to a level above, you know, the pure content of the words.
I guess what I'm saying is I like all sorts of different kinds of music, but again, I've always come back to Dave Matthews Band as just something that it always made me happy. And I can hear deep, deep, deep differences between the different songs and between different versions of the same song. And I guess that brings me to a good question, which is, did you listen to at least a couple of versions of Seek Up that I'd sent you?
No, look around about this, round about this, merry-go-round and around. If at all God's gaze upon us falls, it's with a mischievous grin. Look at him, forget about the reason and the treasons we are seeking.
I did. And this is something I made notes about, because I couldn't listen to all of the actual versions that you gave me links to because Spotify, you know.
Of course.
But I did seek out lots of different versions on YouTube and what have you from different gigs. So obviously, you know, if you're there for different tours and stuff, you know, you're probably going to get different versions.
Sure.
And yes, I could hear the differences, but, and this may come back again to the whole, you know, sort of prog rock thing. It was no more than I'd expect from a live version by a real band. And what I mean by that is obviously, you know, an actual rock band that plays their own instruments and writes their own music. Do people normally expect live versions to sound exactly like the recorded version? Because I don't. That would be dull as hell.
I agree. Yeah, I wouldn't say that it's a normal expectation, but especially in a society where you're used to Britney Spears or One Direction or what have you, it's not that expected to have wildly different versions of the same song. Now, to be fair, I'm talking more about entertainers that happen to be musically themed right now than I am true musicians. And to your point, Anthony, like my favorite band in the world right now is probably Mute Math. And I've seen them live a handful of times. And to your point, even though they are by no means a jam band, their versions of their songs live are wildly different than the ones you hear in the studio. I think what makes Dave Matthews qualify and classify as a jam band in my eyes is that they can take a song that a studio recording is maybe 5 or 6 minutes. And Seek Up is a great example of that. That was from Under the Table and Dreaming. It was, I don't have it in front of me, but something to the order of 6 minutes in the studio version. I had asked Anthony to listen to the version from Dave Matthews and Tim Reynolds' live album, Live at Luther College. Whether or not you did is kind of irrelevant, but
no, I did, and it's about 13 minutes long, isn't it?
I think it's less than that, but it's long, for sure. It's okay. 8, 9, 10 minutes, something
felt
like that. Yeah, right? It felt like an hour. But the interesting thing about that is Dave Matthews himself, not the band, but just Dave Matthews, will tour with that lead guitarist I talked about, Tim Reynolds. Oftentimes, he will tour just the two of them and do just two guitars, both lead guitars. It's not like a bass guitar and a rhythm guitar or anything like that, just two acoustic six-string guitars. And they will tour and do Dave Matthews songs acoustically. And to my ears, the Seek Up that they play and the Seek Up on Under the Table and Dreaming and the Seek Up from, say, Live at Red Rocks, or I forget exactly which album I had asked you to listen to, but one of the full band live albums, all three of those Seek Ups, absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt, they are the same song, but they're very different cuts of the same song. And so to me, I guess it's a fine line to your point, whether it's a band that actually can play music well or if it's a jam band.
Right.
And I think that the other way that they classify in my eyes or ears as a jam band is because a lot of times songs that are only 5 or maybe even 10 minutes on a studio album, although that happens rarely, can go to 15, 20, 25, even 30 minutes in a live show. Two Step from Crash is a great example of this. A song that I, off the top of my head, was probably 5 minutes on the studio album, but I've heard 20 and 25 minute versions of Two Step where everyone in the band gets a solo. And that's, depending on who you are, that's either the worst experience you can possibly imagine
or the greatest
experience you can possibly imagine. And so I don't know what the textbook definition of jam band is. And for all I know, I've just described all the reasons that the Dave Matthews Band isn't a jam band, but I think of a jam band as a group that takes a song and just makes it very, very different, or even mixes in an entirely different song. So like Dreaming Tree from Before These Crowded Streets, I was listening to it, a live recording with my wife, Erin, years ago, and I recognized some riff that Leroy Moore, the saxophonist, was doing, and I couldn't place it. And I had to do some searching on the internet to figure out what was he kind of mixing into this song, into this 20-minute song. Turns out it was Chocolate Rain, which may or may not mean anything to you, but it's like this Indian kid, and I mean, or and he might have been 30 at the time, but he looked like he was 12, and he has this unbelievably deep voice and sings this original composition, Chocolate Rain. And it turns out that Leroy Moore took that riff, which I'm not going to sing to you because I can't sing, but took that riff and integrated it into Dreaming Tree. And to me, yes, any band can do that. Just because you mix in a different song doesn't by default make you a jam band, but
it's the way you do it.
Right. And it took a while for me to even realize, oh, that's an entirely different song that's just been mixed into Dreaming Tree to make something that's kind of not really Dreaming Tree and kind of not really Chocolate Rain either.
No, that actually reminds me of, I was going to mention firstly, again, Genesis were famous during their sort of prog pomp heyday of doing medleys of some of their instrumental songs, because they're the sort of band that used to have at least one instrumental track per album. And during some of their tours in the 70s and early 80s, they would just do these 20-minute medleys where they would mix three or four different instrumental songs from different periods of their career as well, you know, from vastly different albums in style, but they just blend them all together into a big medley. And again, you'd only ever get that live. That was one of the things I loved about Genesis as a live band. I often prefer listening to their live albums to the studio albums because I think they're more dynamic.
Yep.
But also, it reminds me of two specific things that people probably wouldn't expect because they're not from, you know, jam bands or prog bands. And those are Cliff Burton, Metallica's original bassist, was notorious for playing Lynyrd Skynyrd bass lines.
Really?
What, during like live Metallica concerts? Yeah. He would just slip in a Lynyrd Skynyrd bass line while they were playing, I don't know, Master of Puppets or something.
Really?
Yeah.
I had no idea. That's incredible.
I love that. Because, I mean, if you ever saw Cliff, he was clearly the odd one out in that band. He was, you know, the sort of 1970s denim clad hippie while they were all the leather and studs rock, heavy rockers, you know. It was hilarious. And the Sisters of Mercy. I don't know whether they still do this because I haven't seen them live for some years, but there was a period in my life where I saw them quite regularly live, and they still tour. They haven't released a record in, 15 years now, but they still tour. And they were notorious at one point for, they would open with a cover of Comfortably Numb, the Pink Floyd song, and then would merge it into the final track of their debut album, Some Kind of Stranger, which is a completely different track, but it has more or less the same rhythm and similar chords, not the exact same chords, but similar chords. And they would just blend one into the other. And I would always be there in the pit in the middle, you know, suffocating. Cause even by the first song, it was, you know, there's just sweat hanging in the air. And you'd half the time, you wouldn't even realize, you know, you'd think, oh, hang on, when did that happen? And you'd think back and think, no, I don't know. It just happened at some point. At some point, the song changed. The guitarist played like one different chord out of four, and suddenly we're in a different song.
Yeah, and that's the thing that I love about, and to your point earlier, it not necessarily a jam band, but just a good group of musicians. A group of musicians that you can tell have played together a lot, that really know each other, that can read each other, and they just know what they're doing. And I view the Dave Matthews Band, particularly live, as being that way. And I think part of the reason why I've stuck with the Dave Matthews Band so long is because I have, if my count is correct, seen them live, them or Dave and Tim, 23 times since 1997. And I have, I believe, all 23 concerts on CD in the house. And I didn't...
What?
Yeah, so here's the thing. So this is another great example about the difference between Phish and Dave Matthews Band. And in this case, I think Phish has done it right. Dave Matthews Band got really popular in the United States because they permitted audience recordings of their concerts. And so back at this time in the late 90s, mid to late 90s, what that meant was people would take microphones, not unlike what you and I are using now, put them on telescoping poles, stick them in the middle of the audience and record them to DAT tapes, digital audio tapes. And then what you would do is you would then re-record them onto traditional cassettes because, again, it was the early to mid 90s. And then you would trade cassettes with other fans. Now, I sort of got into this in the late 90s because my dad was a really big computer nerd as well. And we had one of the first CDRs of anyone I knew. And so what I would do is I would trade, before I had any tapes to trade, I would say, oh, send me tapes of what you've got, and I will send you back the same thing on CD. And again, it's 2015 right now, so that's the most unremarkable and perhaps even dumb thing you've ever heard. But in 1997 or whatever this was...
No, that would have been amazing, yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And so I started collecting the concerts that I had been to. Well, fast forward a few years, and now there's a site, dreamingtree.org, that facilitates fans sharing torrents of the concerts that they've downloaded.
Wow.
And again, these are all audience recordings. These are just a couple of mics on a boom or whatever, on a telescoping pole in the middle of the audience. But it's unbelievable the difference between mics in 1995 recorded to recorded to DAT tapes and mics in 2015 recorded to probably SSDs or I don't even know what the tapers are using.
Or an iPad or something.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And it's not great, or it's not flawless by any means, but you'd be surprised how unbelievably good these tapers have gotten at getting audience recordings of these tapes. And so not only do I get to have this unique experience every time I see them live, but then I get to relive that unique experience because within 9 hours of the concert ending, I can go to dreamingtree.org and I can get a torrent of that exact concert. In fact, I can usually get two or three different ones of that concert. Now, the difference between this and Phish is that Phish is, in my opinion, a little bit smarter about it, and they will sell you soundboard recordings of any concert you want, I think within hours of the concert ending.
Oh, well, they make their own.
But that's right. And so you can download them, and I think you can even download them in, what is it, Shorten, or I forget the other file format, but basically completely lossless. It's compressed, but it's not lossy. And obviously that's how the torrents come in for Dave Matthews Band as well. But I mean, let's be honest, what are you really losing if you lossy compress something that started as an audience recording?
Right.
But in the case of Phish, you can get SHN or FLAC. That's the other one. I don't remember what it stands for, but either SHN files or FLAC files from Phish within hours of seeing the concert. Or if you're like Marco, you may not even like going to the concerts, but you love the music. So you just download all these concerts. And again, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Dave Matthews Band isn't a jam band, but if nothing else, that's one of the things that makes them so appealing and makes them really like get a grip on you is because there's almost infinite material that you can get from them. And it changes every year because every year they're touring again. And every year you can either pay Phish, you know, and get their files, or you can download these files from the Dave Matthews Band's fan websites. And so it's easy to get caught up in it. And it's not to say that it's a bad thing. I'm talking about it like it's a darn cult now, but it's easy to get caught up in it. And it's hard to tear yourself away from it because there's always something new. And that to me is both wonderful and weird all at the same time.
Well, and isn't that really the sort of the modern end point, or well, not end point, hopefully not end point, but the modern version, if you like, of the kind of thing that the Grateful Dead used to do.
That's right.
There's a fairly grand, you know, tradition of that sort of rock band. And I mean, the Grateful Dead, I don't think anybody would call them a jam band, but they did used to go on for hours and hours jamming on stage. I don't think they recorded themselves, but they gave the audience permission to record and encourage them to tape trade, I believe.
Yep. My understanding is the Dave Matthews Band taping policy was directly taken from the Grateful, or if not taken, inspired by the Grateful Dead. So you're absolutely right. And I think that's part of the reason why it became so popular. They became so popular with the college crowd because especially early on, they played a lot of colleges. They were founded in Charlottesville, Virginia, which is a place I ended up living after high school
Pure coincidence.
It was, but I assure you, I didn't entirely begrudge it. You have to understand that I went to university or college, if you're an American. I went to university at Virginia Tech, which is in Southwest Virginia. The University of Virginia in Charlottesville was our big rival. And so after I graduated from Tech, I actually moved to the home of our rival, which is insane. But it's like living in the best example I can think of is living and growing up in London and then saying, yeah, you know what? I'll go to Paris. Why not? So I ended up in Charlottesville and it was amazing. But the reason I bring all this up is, you know, if you think about a poor, broke college kid, especially early on, Dave Matthews Band would play for these frat houses in and around Virginia. And then all these frat boys would tape the shows and trade the tapes with their brethren in other, you know, towns or whatever. And next thing you know, you have a pretty popular college band in the Dave Matthews Band. And then it expands beyond the college campuses. And you can see how this kind of snowballs from there. So it is of no surprise to me that a little while ago you said, oh, this sounds like an American college band, because that's exactly what they are.
Really were.
Yep, exactly right.
But that is smart, because that's the modern pro-piracy argument, isn't it? Is that you let people who don't have any, young people who have no money and can't afford to go and buy your 10-album discography, let them get it for free. Because when they are older and they have money, they will... If you know, because you've engendered such loyalty in them, they will then spend way more money on you as a result, because they'll feel good about it because you treated them well.
Right, exactly right. And that's exactly what's happened with me. I mean, I don't buy every live album that Dave Matthews Band releases, but I'll look at every single one and say, okay, are there good songs on here? Are there songs I like on here? Was this a pivotal moment in their history? You know, is there for some reason that I want to have it? And I look at every single one and see if I want it. But I've been talking a lot, and I really want to hear your opinion. And let me just kind of set the stage and just say that. And the other reason I really like the Dave Matthews Band is because the lineup of musicians, I think, is a very eclectic lineup. It's the core group is five people. It's Dave Matthews singing and on acoustic guitar, although he does occasionally play electric guitar in more modern albums. It's Boyd Tinsley on violin, sometimes electric violin. This is not entirely remarkable in and of itself, but it's interesting if you see Boyd Tinsley because he is probably 200 pounds of pure muscle, and he carries this little teeny tiny violin and just plays the snot out of it, which is funny to watch live.
Is he the guy with dreadlocks?
Yes. And his arms are like the size of my waist. And so I feel so bad for his violin bows. But anyway, so Dave Matthews, Boyd Tinsley, Leroy Moore was a member of the band until he had an unfortunate ATV accident and passed away a few years ago now. But he played saxophone, piccolo, and other wind instruments. He has since been replaced by Jeff Coffin, who was a member of Bella Fleck and the Flecktones. Then there's Stefan Lessard, who, when he joined the band, was 16 years old, so oftentimes had to be snuck into the bars they played in the back because he wasn't really legally allowed to be in there. He's on bass. And then Carter Beauford, who, in my personal estimation, and from what I understand, most drummers' estimation, is one of the best drummers alive today, if not the best drummer that is alive today. So it's those five core people. A really weird lineup to have a violinist and a saxophone player in what is by most measures a pop band. Like, that's kind of weird. And I think part of the appeal to me, although also part of the hurdle you have to jump over to get into Dave Matthews, is what is going on with this lineup. So I think I've done more than enough to set up kind of what is Dave Matthews Band. So with that said, tell me about what you heard and what you thought of it.
Well, the first thing I want to say is that I do, despite all the sort of mockery that I've made earlier, I do appreciate a band that is clearly doing something a bit different. And what you said about the lineup reflects that, that this is a band that does not, just because of the instruments they have, does not sound like most American college rock bands.
Sure, sure.
You know, most of them do not have violins. Most of them do not have saxophones. And certainly most of them do not have both of those things. So I really do appreciate a band that is doing their own thing, regardless of fashion or taste. And they clearly are. You can, love or hate them, I could tell that just from listening to the music and looking at some of the live videos on YouTube. They are clearly enjoying what they do. They love their music, and they don't really care if it's fashionable.
Yep, I completely agree.
That just comes across. You can tell that. And that describes the vast majority of my own listening, you know, of like the sort of stuff that I listen to. And I do listen to some popular bands, but I listen, they're popular because they do their own thing, you know, not because they follow fashion or taste. So I can really respect that, even if it is not my thing, which in this case, it kind of isn't, to be honest. It's a bit like, I made jokes about REM, but actually what it reminded me of the most was Counting Crows.
Interesting. Okay.
In the sense that it, you know, it's that American college radio sort of band, and there's nothing wrong with it. It wasn't offensive, but it just didn't, as you said earlier, didn't rev my engine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, to my sensibilities, it felt kind of a bit bland and flat most of the time. There were a few standout tracks on, forgive me, I'm not sure which album these are from, but Drive In, Drive Out. By myself again, it's going to drive me right out of my brain. Drive in, drive out, I'm leaving. Drive in, drive out, I come back again.
That's from Crash. That's the album that they kind of became popular on. Like,
right.
Under the Table and Dreaming, which I mentioned, that's the one Seek Up was on. That was the first one that people started to notice. But Crash is the one, in my personal opinion, that, okay, this is a thing. Like, they became a national band at that time. So Drive In, Drive Out, which I believe, I don't know anything about playing music, but if I recall correctly, it has a very weird time signature or something like that. You tell me. I don't know. But
it might do. I don't know. I think it doesn't have from what I can remember, I don't think it has an odd time signature. It's just that the drums are played in a strange fashion. They're played kind of on the offbeat.
Okay.
And they're sort of, I actually made a note about the drums because I think they're kind of unnecessarily complex in this song. If it had a simpler beat behind it, I think it could be a really great track. But instead, instead I just kept getting distracted by the drummer being clever. I'm like, just stop being clever and just play the goddamn beat, you know?
Right, right.
But that was probably my favorite on the album. And the only other track that I really liked on that album, to be honest, was Cry Freedom. But cold between the fighters slams and the feet are rolling line. But fear between the fighters all slip away.
Oh, interesting. I do not care for Cry Freedom at all.
Well, I liked the chord changes.
Okay.
It has some really nice, unusual chord changes, which is one of the things I love about early REM. You're listening to it, and if you know sort of conventional music, you hear, oh, there's a couple of chords, and you subconsciously, I'm expecting this chord, and then it's something completely different and just blows your ears. And the Cry Freedom had an element of that, the unexpected, unusual chord changes that, that kind of appeals to me. So I did quite like that.
Interesting. Okay. So Drive In, Drive Out, I quite like I said, Cry Freedom, I can take it or leave it. But it's funny to me hearing you criticize, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but you know, criticize Carter's playing because to me, and this is what makes the world go round, right? But to me, that cleverness is what I find so interesting about Carter's playing in that, and I was thinking about this earlier, actually, there was a behind the scenes series of featurettes that I think MTV did about Before These Crowded Streets, which is not the album you're talking about, but one of the albums that I asked you to listen to.
I'm coming to that soon.
and I could swear that Dave Matthews was kind of jokingly, but kind of seriously saying in this behind the scenes featurette that what's interesting about Carter is he's so fast and can play so well that at the end of a take that he did, you would expect him to just have like made fried eggs as he's playing the drums because he can do so much at once. And I think that's, Dave Matthews is actually a very funny man, and so he said it in a much more clever and funny way than I just did. But the point stands that Carter is apparently ambidextrous and plays, again, I don't really know anything about making music, but I guess most drummers kind of cross their hands when they play.
I noticed that he didn't do that on the GoPro video that you sent me. Yeah, he's an open-handed drummer.
I was going to say, I thought it was called open hand. I'm glad you said it before me. So now I know I'm not an idiot, or at least not for that reason. And so, so he uses this open hand thing, which I get my understanding is instead of crossing your arms and hands while you're drumming the way probably a novice would, which in many cases is wrong. But because both of his hands are equally, skilled because he's ambidextrous, he can play weird rhythms in ways that I guess most drummers cannot. And it's that cleverness that I find very appealing. And it's completely reasonable for you to say, oh my gosh, just relax a little bit. But that's one of the things that brings me to Dave Matthews Band. And one of the things I love so much about it.
Well, here's the thing. I love a good drummer. Like I am kind of, I was a front man when I was in and out of bands in my early years. Mm-hmm. I play a bit of guitar badly. I play a bit of bass badly. I was mainly a front man. And I think most front men are actually frustrated drummers. And I love watching a good drummer. Like I said, Genesis, you know, Phil Collins, one of the greatest drummers of all time. Mm-hmm. Their touring drummer, Chester Thompson, an amazing drummer. He used to play with Weather Report and Frank Zappa. When they used to do their big 70s and 80s concerts, they had two drum sets on stage and they would do drum duets. And it was amazing. You know, the technical ability was astounding, but they got behind the groove of the song. They weren't unnecessarily complex when it wasn't called for.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I do love a good sort of drum cam.
yeah.
Which has become a thing in recent years. I don't know if you've seen this, but drum cams where somebody will literally just set up like a GoPro or I suppose it would have been a flip, but now it's probably just somebody's iPhone behind the drum kit and just film the drummer during a live gig.
Mm-hmm.
So that all you can hear is the drums and you can just about hear the music in the background, really tinny. That's a real thing. And it seems to be that a lot of actual drum manufacturers are sponsoring this. Getting the people who endorse their drums to have these videos taken and then they put them on YouTube and go, look how brilliant our drums out, right. drummer who endorses us and all that.
You too could drum like this.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, you know, and I am at heart a heavy metal fan, so I love a good drummer. Back in a previous episode, when I was talking to Brian Letendry about Megadeth, I made the point that for me, great metal is percussive and emotional, not just technical. Now, most heavy metal drummers are very, very skilled and technical musicians, but they don't sort of show off about it. Most of the time, some of them do, but you know, most of them focus on the rhythm of the music, because by itself, the technical musicianship can leave me cold anyway. There has to be more emotion in it, which I think Carter Beauford has. Clearly, I mean, I could see in those videos, he is clearly playing on the groove. He's got emotion into it. He's in, you know, putting some swing into it. You can see that he's clearly into it and getting into the song. But for me, yeah, there was a little bit of unnecessary paradiddles and all that stuff just, you know, going on. It reminded me, there's a link that I will put in the show notes and I will send to you, actually. One of my favorite drum cam style videos is of Gene Hoglan, who's a heavy metal drummer who made his name playing with Death, the Floridian death metal band back in the 90s. He is enormously skilled, but he also has a lot of groove and rhythm. And there's a great video of him at a drum clinic in a store a few years back, drumming along to the pre-record of a track by Death called Overactive Imagination. And it is amazing because he has one of the smallest kits you have ever seen for a pro drummer. He's a huge guy. And obviously, because he's doing this clinic in a store, he's just got a really tiny basic kit. It's like about a 9-piece kit or something. It's, you know, compared to what I saw Carter Beauford using on those
ridiculous
gigs,
yeah,
where he's got like a 50-piece drum kit.
Yeah.
And this thing Gene Hoglan's using, it looks like a toy drum kit in comparison, but he gets the most amazing results out of it. And you can see in the way he plays, even though he's playing death metal, you can see the sort of the groove in it and that he's really into the song. So I'll have to send you that.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see it. And it's funny you bring up the small kit, because this band that I mentioned earlier, Mute Math, their drummer is, I think, their far and away best musician. And there's only four of them, you know, typical standard band arrangement. But anyways, their drummer, Darren King, plays this teeny tiny kit. It's probably like with cymbals, it's gotta be a 10-piece kit.
Yeah.
But probably not unlike Carter, plays these rhythms that shouldn't be able to be played on a drum. Like, it's just too fast. it's too fast to be possible. And where I've listened to some things that I would classify as metal. Like, there was a time when I really liked Metallica. It was brief, but I really liked Metallica, and I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing in this context, but but to me, like, oftentimes what I would think of as a metal drummer, like a Lars Ulrich, anyway, like Lars, is it very fast, you know, not like an Eddie Van Halen sort of thing on guitar, just very fast, lots of hitting, lots of movement. And that's not really what I'm talking about with Darren King or with Carter necessarily. It's just that there's rhythms on top of rhythms, at least to my ear anyway. And that I find very interesting and fun to listen to. And whether or not that's your thing, that's totally fine. But that is very appealing to me.
No, I know exactly what you mean. Thinking actually, one of my all time favorite band is a doom metal band called Paradise Lost. Oh, it's sort of gothic metal more than doom. And a few albums ago, they were without a drummer. So they used a session drummer for one of their albums. Faith Divides Us, Death Unites Us. And the session drummer was amazing. And he had exactly that quality. It's like, this is a goth metal band. They do not play fast. They're not playing, you know, double time, double kick blast beats that you'd get from like Slayer or something.
Yeah,
they are
playing
regular tempo and even quite slow in places music. But yeah, the drummer is layering so many things on top of all these relatively slow rhythms. It was amazing.
Yep.
I can't remember his name, but I saw a brief video of him playing in the studio during the recording sessions. And I was just amazed at his ability to move around the drum kit at speed, even though he wasn't playing, really fast blast beats or something.
Yep. And that to me is very interesting. So now, to kind of sum up the drummer line, you would say that Carter is a skilled drummer, but he's not really your style. Is that fair to summarize?
Well, not on that first album.
Okay.
The second album that you had me listen to, which I think is the one that you said is your favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, what was it called?
Before These Crowded Streets.
That's the one.
Okay.
I generally thought was a better album. overall. Rapunzel,
I
thought had a nice swing to it.
For you, I would crawl through the darkest dungeon, climb a castle wall. If you're my Rapunzel, let your hair down, riding through the window. Could they lock the door? 'Cause I do my best for you.
See, that's a good example, I think, of good rhythm, where you can tell the drummer knows what he's doing, but he's not unnecessarily filling every space with you know, something on the drums.
Sure.
And Last Stop.
And how is this hate so deep? Lead us all so blindly, killing, killing fools are we? It hates the gate to peace. Well, this is the last stop.
And I think those are the first two tracks on that album. And that was a really strong opener. I was like, oh, wow, okay, this is, considering that this is the very next album, you could see there'd been a huge progression in songwriting, in dynamics, in the way they were playing. I was really impressed. Unfortunately, the rest of the album was a bit of a letdown compared to that. But it still sounded overall better than the previous album. So, you know,
sure.
Overall, that's good, I guess. But those two songs at the start were, in my opinion, far superior to anything on the previous album.
Yeah. And again, so much of the reason I love this album is because of the time it came out, because it was that extremely, pivotal moment in my life. But I think it's fair to say that a lot of Dave Matthews Band fans view this as arguably the pinnacle, because this is when kind of everything was really clicking. And everything was the way we remember, you know, it was one of those things. It was the way we remember it, you know,
right.
You know, and it's like, then everything to, you know, the producer changed either the next album, Steve Lillywhite, who had produced a lot of very popular bands. He changed either the next album or the one after, then a few years after that, Leroy Moore passed away, you know, so everything changed, but this was like that moment.
This is really quite early to have a pinnacle, don't you think? I mean, it was only, what, their third album or something?
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned that, because I was thinking about that earlier. I said, geez, 98 was a long time ago now.
Exactly, yeah.
And, I mean, their last album, I don't even remember the name of their last album. Now, that's partially because I don't care as much about Dave Matthews Band as I used to, but partially because, you know what? It wasn't really that good. Away from the World, I think it was, but it wasn't really that great, you know? And I really love Before These Crowded Streets. Rapunzel is phenomenal. In fact, I was listening to it obscenely loudly just a few hours ago because it is so good. And the bass line in here, that's when it was, when I started to realize, wow, this is almost Stefan's album, the bassist's album, because I felt like that bass line just smacked me upside the head. It was something I never really paid close attention to before. And then I listened to it. I was like, man, he is quick and he is good. But in a lot of the way I think you're talking, Anthony, about drummers, Stefan just kind of fills in that gap the way it needs to be filled and doesn't go a step beyond that.
Right.
And I really appreciated that in Rapunzel, especially. And I also thought that Spoon at the very end, it's the very last song on the album. It was, I could see how it would be a very polarizing track, because in a lot of ways it's the epitome of the Dave Matthews Band. So either you're going to really like it or you're going to really hate it. But I loved it, because here it was a very slow tempo, a song that kind of built over time, which is something I'm a sucker for. And it featured a really good, banjo solo by Bella Fleck. And from what I understand, again, don't know anything about making music, but I guess playing the banjo slowly is a very hard thing to do. And this was a very, very slow banjo solo.
It is. The banjo has almost no resonance. Like with a guitar, when you hit a note, it rings and lasts for, you know,
yeah, ding. Yeah.
When you do that on a banjo, it goes ding.
Yeah, exactly.
That's basically the difference. So yeah, playing it slowly requires a great deal of patience, I think, more than anything.
Yep. And so there's this really solid banjo solo, very slow and solid banjo solo. Carter, I thought, did a phenomenal job. Although here again, if you recall the song at all, you might tell me, Anthony, that it was a little too fiddly for your taste. And then they also had Alanis Morissette sing a verse in it. And again, speaking of polarizing.
Oh, is that who that was? I thought I recognized that voice, but I couldn't place it.
Yeah. And again, maybe unjustly maligned, maybe justly maligned, maybe not maligned at all. But Alanis, especially in 98, was, you know, kind of doing really well.
Mm-hmm.
And she appears on the, you know, and she was, I would describe her music as an angrier rock music than Dave Matthews Band. Perhaps not angry in the grand scheme of things, but a lot angrier than Dave Matthews
Band.
No, I'd
agree with that. Yeah.
And here it is. She's in this, she's singing this beautiful verse in this very slow, very melodic song. And I just thought this was, oh, and a great guitar solo by Tim Reynolds as well. And so in a lot of ways, this was like the epitome of the Dave Matthews, or maybe the pinnacle of the Dave Matthews Band. Even though Spoon is not one of my favorite songs, I like it a lot. And actually, I really like the album version a lot. But there are other songs on the same album that I like considerably more. But it is a great case study in almost a small jam song that's definitely well-produced, definitely a studio track, very clearly one that they worked on hard and made lots of attempts at. But it was a very good encapsulation of kind of everything that Dave Matthews Band is.
And I think that's probably a good place, a nice summation and a good place to bring this to a close. Because we have been going on for quite a while.
I'm sorry I've made you talk about this for so long.
No, not at all. I will talk music about, you know, any kind of music with anyone. As anybody who listened to the Megadeth episode will, and I don't even like Megadeth, but I will happily just talk about music, you know, for a long time. So, yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, I'm probably not going to listen to Dave Matthews Band again, but, you know, I can now understand where fans of it are coming from, at least. Whereas before, as I say, I'd literally never even knowingly heard a song.
Mm-hmm.
So I would encourage, you know, if you're a listener out there and that is your sort of thing, and actually you do like Counting Crows or that sort of, you know, college rock sort of style music, you could definitely do worse than seeking out Dave Matthews Band, I'd say, because it is something different. Even though it's in that genre, they are at least doing their own thing.
Yeah, I would agree. And like I said, even I don't listen to it near as much as I used to, but but it is a lot better and I would say a lot more interesting, if nothing else, than a lot of other things, especially for that era, especially the late 90s. You know, this is around the time that the Backstreet Boys and like NSYNC and Britney Spears were all really big. And then here's this out of nowhere college band that actually, especially in America, was for a brief window of time, probably almost as popular as Britney Spears and all that. So, you know, whether or not anyone listening is a fan, it's certainly something that's a little bit different than what you'd hear in most other places. So.
All right. So, Casey, if people don't already know, where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
Sure. So I write for my website, which is at caseylist.com. I'm on Twitter at caseylist. And then you might know me from one of the two podcasts I regularly record, the smaller one, but potentially more interesting one, depending on what your particular interests are, is Analog, spelled either the proper way or the British way, depending on how you look at it. So that is ANALOG parentheses UE. And that is at relay.fm/analog. And then the other podcast that I do is the one that I'm probably more known for. That is the Accidental Tech Podcast. And that is at ATP.fm.
What is the actual remit of Analog? I've often wondered, is there a sort of mission statement?
Not really. So the
well, that's what I figured.
The closest thing to a mission statement is that we like to talk about the space between zero and one. So in other words, you know, there are all these digital things in our lives, but Analog is kind of about, how does that make you feel? You know, what feelings are associated with your digital world? And so this is myself and my dear friend Mike Hurley, who hails from London, and we talk about kind of all just various and sundry things related to the digital world, but how it interacts with the real world and how it makes you feel.
The space between zero and one. Are you quite sure you've never taken any hallucinogenic drugs? You've been listening to Unjustly Maligned, episode 18, with Anthony Johnston and Casey Liss. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. If you're enjoying the show, please do consider taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes. It really helps. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.